If companies aren't competing on their ability to innovate and develop better products, if they're competing on their ability to schmooze, that's bad for everybody.
President Trump has been using taxpayer money to buy shares of private companies for the federal government. We look at the implications this Monday, January 19th, on All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang. After the U.S. blockade on Venezuela, Cuba has looked to Mexico for oil.
I believe that a government that's actually helping the adversaries of the United States, we ought to take that into consideration when the terms of our negotiations are being considered.
Also, a civil rights museum in Atlanta has just expanded to include the era of Reconstruction and the Jim Crow laws that followed.
We cannot go with the wave of what's happening outside our doors. We just have to tell the truth of history.
And a cancer drug has become quite popular after the Trump administration endorsed it as a treatment for autism. Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. President Trump's push for the U.S. to take over Greenland is escalating. NPR's Barbara Sprunt reports the Norwegian prime minister confirmed he received a message from Trump about the Nobel Prize being a factor in his approach.
On Saturday, President Trump announced new tariffs on 8 European nations, pledging to increase the rate if a deal for the U.S. to acquire Greenland is not reached. Norway's prime minister said in a statement that he had sent a text to Trump on behalf of himself and the president of Finland to express opposition to those tariffs. In it, he urged de-escalation and proposed a call to discuss. According to the prime minister, President Trump responded by saying that because Norway did not give him a Nobel Peace Prize, he no longer feels, quote, an obligation to think purely of peace. The Nobel Prize is awarded by an independent committee, not the Norwegian government. Barbara Sprunt, NPR News, Copenhagen.
The Pentagon has ordered about 1,500 active duty soldiers to be ready in case of a possible deployment to Minnesota as the Trump administration continues its immigration crackdown there. President Trump has threatened to invoke the Insurrection Act, a rarely used law that allows him to send troops to enforce the law. The soldiers are based in Alaska and specialize in operating in Arctic conditions. Minnesota Public Radio's Clay Masters has more.
We should be clear that the troops are on standby, and this comes as Governor Walz has directed the Minnesota National Guard to prepare for possible deployment to assist local law enforcement and emergency management agencies. It really remains to be seen what that would look like to have two units potentially receiving conflicting orders.
Minnesota Public Radio's Clay Masters. Israeli forces have launched a new military raid in the occupied West Bank. The military says it's seizing weapons in the region's largest Palestinian city, Nuha Musla reports.
The military raid is in the city of Hebron. The Israeli military says it is dismantling, quote, terror infrastructure and seizing weapons. It says the raid will last several days, and it warned explosions may be heard in the area. This military raid is taking place in an area where there have been days of shooting in a local dispute among members of a Palestinian family, in an area under Israeli security control. Zlicha Mohtasib, a resident of the area, told NPR she has heard the sounds of shooting and explosions. She says Israeli forces have imposed a curfew and closed off all entrances to Hebron. This comes amid a recent escalation of violence in Palestinian areas involving Israeli settlers and soldiers. For NPR News, I'm Noha Musleh in Ramallah, the West Bank.
The annual meeting of business, government, and culture elites in Davos, Switzerland is this week. It takes place as President Trump has unsettled markets and allies alike with his America First agenda. This is NPR News from Washington. Prince Harry's legal battle against British tabloids has entered its final round. A trial for his challenge against the Daily Mail is expected to last 9 weeks in London's High Court. His lawyer says the outlet unlawfully gathered information for 2 decades, leaving Harry distressed and paranoid. The case also involves celebrities Elton John and Elizabeth Hurley. The tabloid's parent company denies the allegations. Italian fashion designer Valentino Garavani has died at the age of 93. NPR's Andrew Limbong Armstrong reports he was one of the leaders of high fashion and shaped the definition of Italian style.
Valentino Garavani was very much of the old guard of high fashion titans. Think Giorgio Armani or Karl Lagerfeld. Known best by his first name, Valentino was singularly focused on women's beauty. He dressed everyone from Jackie Kennedy to Elizabeth Taylor to Meryl Streep to Princess Diana. And he had a signature color, Valentino Red, a rich and vibrant red that pops on a dress. He was born in 1932, heading to Paris as a teen to study fashion and art. In 1960, he teamed up with businessman Giancarlo Giammetti to found the label that would turn Valentino's name into a symbol of haute couture. Valentino retired in 2008. According to his foundation, he will lie in state in a piazza in Rome on Wednesday with a funeral on Friday. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
A strong geomagnetic storm could soon hit Earth's atmosphere, bringing the potential for the northern lights to be seen farther south than usual. The massive burst of solar material and magnetic field from the sun's outer atmosphere is expected to reach Earth within the next 24 hours. I'm Ryland Barton. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Pew Charitable Trusts, sharing about the state of housing in America on the After the Fact podcast, available at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact, and the Doris Duke Foundation.
It is 4:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. Programming is supported by The Forge in Grand Rapids, offering a space where students, entrepreneurs, and workers can bring their ideas to evolve into products, careers, or businesses, building a culture of innovation and diversity in the heart of Itasca County. Learn more at theforgeitasca.org, where ideas take shape. Now back to All Things Considered.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang. President Trump has spent his first year back in office rewriting the rules of U.S. capitalism, blurring the lines between business and government. That is generating a lot of questions and worries about the future of the U.S. economy. NPR financial correspondent Maria Aspen reports.
Intel is one of America's original tech startups. Remember this sound from its Intel Inside commercials? Founded back in 1968, Intel made some of the first computer chips that have become so crucial to today's tech boom. By the start of this century, its chips had made the tech company into a giant of American capitalism. But last year, Intel became something very different, a symbol of how much President Trump is taking control of private companies. In August, Trump publicly threatened Intel CEO Lip-Bu Tan, calling for his resignation over his ties to China. Then Tan went to the White House to meet with Trump.
I said, you know what? I think the United States should be given 10% of Intel.
And now the United States owns a chunk of Intel and several other companies. It's also seeking more control over today's tech darling, NVIDIA. Trump wants NVIDIA to pay the U.S. a 25% cut of some sales in China as a condition of allowing it to sell some computer chips there. Trump often makes these deals with CEOs who have gone out of their way to court him, sometimes donating to his personal projects. Like NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang, who's among the tech billionaires and companies funding Trump's controversial White House ballroom. Here's Huang in April at a White House press conference.
And so I want to thank you, sir, for everything that you've done and the strong encouragement and the great policies that make it possible for us. Thank you, sir.
CEOs have always tried to court the White House, whoever its occupant. But for the U.S. government, which almost never takes a direct stake in U.S. companies, this is a huge break from tradition. Now business experts across the political spectrum are worried that the United States is starting to look more like China.
If companies aren't competing on their ability to innovate and develop better products, if they're competing on their ability to schmooze, then, I mean, that's bad for everybody.
Ann Lipton has been working in corporate law for decades. She's a professor at the University of Colorado's law school. She says that when the government picks winners and losers, companies have less incentive to compete with each other. That leads to less innovation and less spending and less job creation, which can all hurt the economy. This has long been the conventional wisdom in Washington and on Wall Street.
If you believe that the free market is the best way of generating resources and innovations and everything, then this just sort of messes with that.
It certainly messes with what's known as free market capitalism, which for decades has been the gospel of corporate America.
We are seeing a shift away from the type of rules-based capitalism that has made America's economy so robust.
Daniela Ballou Ayres founded a consulting company and served in the Obama administration. Now she runs the Leadership Now Project, a coalition of business leaders that has endorsed political candidates from both parties. She's worried that the United States is even at risk of tipping over into crony capitalism, meaning that companies rise and fall based on how much a political leader likes them. Like, say, the Russian billionaires who own oil companies under Vladimir Putin.
What we have right now is a lot of personalized decision-making, chaotic decision-making, instability that we're seeing the cost of.
A White House official speaking to NPR on condition of anonymity largely dismisses these concerns and says that companies like Intel and NVIDIA are crucial to U.S. national and economic security. And to be sure, the U.S. stock market is booming away. Intel didn't respond to requests for comment. In an emailed statement, an NVIDIA spokesperson says its discussions with President Trump have focused, quote, on his desire for America to win as a nation. Ballou Ayres says that it's tough for business leaders to know how to stand up to Trump, especially after he's threatened some of them.
You don't want to say anything unless it's like clearly exactly in your core interest, in your core business, and at no risk.
But she warns that crony capitalism can have some pretty dire consequences for the overall economy, but also for individual business leaders. In extreme cases, like Russia, executives who fall out of favor then sometimes fall out of windows.
The cronies and crony capitalism, they don't end up, look at the oligarchs in Russia. You know, it doesn't really end well for many of them. And you can't predict if you're one who ends up okay or not.
Russia is an extreme example. But she hopes it's an early warning to U.S. business leaders to stand up for free market capitalism, if not for the sake of the economy, at least for their own long-term self-interest. Maria Aspen, NPR News.
Cuba used to get a lot of oil from Venezuela, but ever since the U.S. began its blockade on that country, those shipments have plummeted. The island is having constant blackouts, and now the Trump administration, which wants to topple the Cuban government, has turned its focus to Mexico, which has become Cuba's biggest provider of oil. NPR's Ada Peralta reports.
Just days after the U.S. seized President Nicolas Maduro, Republican Representative Carlos Jimenez took aim at a new target. In front of a chart, he showed that over the past 5 years, most oil shipped to Cuba came from Venezuela.
Now, as Venezuela started to drop their contribution, Mexico started to pick things up.
Indeed, Kepler, a global trade tracker, found Mexico had increased its oil shipments to Cuba and had become its most important provider. Russia and China's contributions were negligible. Representative Jimenez then issued a threat.
I believe that a government that's actually helping the adversaries of the United States, we ought to take that into consideration when the terms of our negotiations are being considered.
The Mexico-Cuba relationship is complicated. Ricardo Pasco Pierce, who served as Mexican ambassador to Cuba in the early 2000s, says it has survived U.S. pressure and goes back decades. Even during the Cold War, Mexico maintained functional relations with Cuba. In part, Pasco says, it's symbolic of a deeply held belief that Mexico should remain unaligned.
It permits you to be able to kind of hold the superpowers at a distance. Because if you don't hold them at a distance, they're absolutely overbearing.
Mexico, says Pasco, has always played both sides. Cuban revolutionaries would be allowed to fly through Mexico, and Mexico would then pass their pictures and information to the CIA.
So Mexico played this dual role of pleasing everybody, let's put it that way.
But in the 90s, Mexico decided to sign a free trade agreement with the United States, and since then, it has become structurally dependent on the North, says Pasco, making U.S. demands way more meaningful.
It's difficult for Mexico to play the duality.
Right now, says Pasco, Mexican oil exports are not significant enough to keep Cuba afloat the way Venezuela did. But one thing is clear, he says. If there comes a time when Mexico has to choose between Cuba and the U.S., it will have to pick the U.S. So the oil Mexico is sending to Cuba may well be the last expression of that lasting relationship.
I think this is sort of a historic hiccup at the end of a long road.
The Mexican government, for its part, insists that it will keep supporting Cuba. It's a humanitarian imperative, President Claudia Sheinbaum said. Plus, she added, a sovereign country gets to decide how it uses its resources. Ada Peralta, NPR News, Mexico City.
Museums across the country are under pressure to comply with President Trump's executive order to remove what his administration calls race-centered ideology. The National Center for Civil and Human Rights in Atlanta, the birthplace of Martin Luther King Jr., is doubling down. It recently expanded its exhibit space to include the era of Reconstruction following the Civil War. Julian Virgin from member station WABE paid a visit.
Sounds of struggle, triumph, and the voices of kids echo through the National Center of Civil and Human Rights in downtown Atlanta.
Miss Wortham's group right here.
Fourth grade math teacher Julianne Wortham is here with 60 elementary students from a local school.
This is their history. It gets them to reflect on who they are and what legacy they can leave as African American students.
From the lunch counter sit-ins to the March on Washington, students walk through immersive recreations of civil rights moments from the early 20th century in the segregated South through the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr.
I just think this is a momentous moment for our students to get exposure, to see where they come from, so that we won't repeat the past.
Recently, the center added on to its exhibit space. Now, instead of beginning in the 20th century, the history lesson starts in the 1860s Reconstruction era following the end of the Civil War.
That 100-year period really puts things in context in American history.
Chief Program Officer Kayma Pierce is in charge of the new exhibit, Broken Promises, the legacy of the Reconstruction era. She says while laws changed after slavery, the culture did not. And within a few years, Jim Crow segregation laws took hold. The exhibit shows images of racial violence, maps of lynchings and massacres of Wilmington, Atlanta, and Tulsa.
That's why this space is so important. Because how do you understand the struggles, even now or during the civil rights movement, if you don't understand, you know, the treatment of these people back then?
From the Smithsonian Institution to national parks, many places around the country are under pressure to cut so-called divisive concepts out of how they represent American history. But Pierce is not deterred. She says the center gets a limited amount of federal funds and relies mostly on corporate foundation and individual contributions.
We cannot go with the wave of what's happening outside our doors. We just have to tell the truth of history.
And she says they welcome the weight of the responsibility to keep telling what she says is the full American story. For NPR News, I'm Julian Virgin in Atlanta.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:18, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is your Daily Dose of Phenology with John Latimer. Deep Portage Learning Center in Hackensack has their annual Winter Rendezvous Saturday, January 24th. Enjoy a day of outdoor winter activities such as axe throwing, snow snakes, and more. Registration begins at 9 a.m. with games until 2 and a chili feed at noon. Find more info at deep-portage.org.
On today's date, January 19th, 1989, I watch just before sunset as three ruffed grouse dance on the very end branches of the aspens in my forest. They are, of course, dining on the buds that they're finding out there, grabbing that last bit of protein before they go into the snow to spend the night. And the aspen provides a very nourishing source of protein for them. It's a big bud, and it is full of protein. And they can get up there and eat that bud and gain the sort of energy that they're going to need to carry them through the night in a short period of time. Now, the aspen oftentimes will fight back, and it fights back by producing a chemical that makes its bud bitter. And that will make the grouse switch their food source from aspen to birch or ironwood. And when the grouse do that, it requires them to spend more time gathering food because the protein levels aren't nearly as high in these other buds. And the longer they spend gathering food, the greater exposure to danger they present. And so they would much rather eat the aspen buds than fight for the birch and ironwood buds.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Odoo, maker of all-in-one management software with the goal of being simple to use for all employees. Learn more about Odoo at odoo.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ilse Chang. A once obscure cancer drug has become a celebrity in the autism community. The drug is called leucovorin, and it's been in high demand since the Trump administration endorsed it as a treatment for some children with autism. NPR's John Hamilton reports that the drug joins a long list of autism remedies whose popularity has outpaced the science.
At a press conference in September, federal officials made some big claims about leucovorin, a prescription drug usually reserved for cancer patients. Here's Dr. Marty McCarry, commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration.
We are going to change the label to make it available. Hundreds of thousands of kids, in my opinion, will benefit.
Months later, the FDA has yet to make good on McCarry's promise. Since his remarks, though, nearly 25,000 people have joined a Facebook group called Leucovorin for Autism. And some doctors have started writing off-label prescriptions. That's led to a shortage of the drug, which the FDA is trying to fix by allowing imports of a version sold in Canada. It's all part of a familiar cycle for Dr. Paul Offit of the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Offit says he realized years ago that leucovorin was a dead end.
I saw it for what it was, which was yet the next magic medicine to treat autism in a long line of magic medicines to treat autism that haven't worked.
Offit has chronicled the rise and fall of many of those products in his books and blog posts.
First it was secretin, an intestinal hormone. Then it was Lupron, chemical castration, antibiotics, specifically antifungals, because you just needed to control yeast in the intestine, megavitamins, nicotine patches, and then my personal favorite, which is raw camel's milk.
Offit expects leucovorin to find a place on that cautionary list.
I think the FDA has failed here to stand between the public and the pharmaceutical industry to make sure that we get drugs that are tested to be safe and effective when this clearly hasn't been well tested to be effective.
The rationale for leucovorin's use in autism rests on its link to a form of vitamin B called folate and to a condition called cerebral folate deficiency. The deficiency affects brain development. Children who have it are prone to seizures, muscle weakness, cognitive impairment, and in some cases, autism. One cause of cerebral folate deficiency is a rare genetic mutation that blocks folate in the bloodstream from reaching the brain. Another cause was proposed about 20 years ago by scientists including Edward Quadros of SUNY Downstate Medical Center.
I've been researching folate for almost three decades.
Quadros suggested that cerebral folate deficiency could also be caused by the body's own immune system. How? By making an antibody that acted like that rare genetic mutation to prevent folate in the bloodstream from reaching the brain. In 2005, Quadros co-authored a study suggesting a link between this deficiency and autism. The study involved 28 children being treated by a doctor in Germany for a range of developmental disorders. All of these kids had low levels of folate in their cerebrospinal fluid, the liquid that surrounds the brain and spinal cord. But Quadros says the doctor in Germany didn't know why.
So he contacted us and asked, Could this be an autoimmune disorder? Would you look at it?
Quadros says blood samples from the 28 children showed that 25 of them were carrying antibodies capable of blocking folate.
So we had an explanation why, even though they had normal circulating folate, the brain was not getting folate.
Quadro says his team thought they could correct the deficiency with leucovorin.
It's basically a derivative of folate, which can bypass and go through an alternate pathway into the brain.
When children in the study got leucovorin, folate levels in their brains went up, and some kids even appeared to get better. The results percolated through the autism community for more than a decade. Then, in 2018, another small study amplified interest in the drug. It found that among 48 autistic children with language impairment, those who got leucovorin for 12 weeks showed greater improvement in verbal skill. Dr. Richard Fry was the lead author and remains a prominent advocate for leucovorin treatment. But even Fry says it's no cure.
This isn't a panacea. This isn't the autism pill. It definitely can help some kids. Some kids, you know, respond dramatically, but that's not the norm.
Most improve slowly over many years, he says, and require a range of therapies in addition to leucovorin. Fry studied the drug during appointments at the University of Arkansas and then the University of Arizona. He left both institutions after they questioned his research and now practices at a private clinic. Fry believes many children with autism do have cerebral folate deficiency, but confirming the deficiency requires a spinal tap, which can be painful. As a result, Fry says he and other researchers typically use a less reliable measure, the presence of folate-blocking antibodies in a child's blood.
So we can't say they have cerebral folate deficiency, which is specifically defined as a level below normal, but we can say, okay, there's some type of block that would put them at risk for having cerebral folate deficiency.
Another caveat is that leucovorin appears to help many children who do not even have the folate-blocking antibodies. Fry says this suggests that leucovorin is working in other ways.
There's strong data that this is really a very promising treatment. Is it enough for changing of the label? That's up to the FDA.
Fry says he's working on a randomized controlled trial of a purified form of leucovorin that should offer clearer results. In the meantime, the FDA is relying on studies that are badly flawed, says Dr. Shefali Jeste, the chair of pediatrics at the University of California, Los Angeles.
These trials have been conducted without the rigor that we would really want to determine that something should be FDA approved for autism more broadly.
So Jeste doesn't prescribe leucovorin. And when parents ask her about it, she has a standard response.
If I had a pill that I could give your child to help them talk or to completely reverse the core symptoms of autism, I would be the first to be prescribing it because we would love to have a treatment like that, right? We don't have one.
At least one segment of the autism community has already tried leucovorin and found it lacking. Decades ago, the drug became a popular treatment for children with Fragile X syndrome, a leading inherited cause of autism. Dr. Michael Tranfalia is the parent of an adult child with Fragile X and severe autism. Tranfalia is also the medical director of FRAXA, a foundation that funds research on the genetic condition. He says early on, scientists realized that the chromosomal differences found in Fragile X were visible only in cells deprived of folate.
So the very first and most obvious theory was that Fragile X must have something to do with folic acid metabolism.
Parents started giving folic acid to their kids with Fragile X. When that didn't work, they moved on to folinic acid, or leucovorin.
People tried it, and that seemed to work better than the regular folic acid, and there was a lot of excitement about that, until people started doing actual clinical trials, and then they realized it was pretty hard to show that it was any more effective than placebo.
Now, Tranfalia says, leucovorin is back.
It's not terribly surprising, because for every supplement and every vitamin you can possibly imagine, someone has proposed some kind of link to autism.
Usually, though, that someone is not running the FDA, the agency that determines whether a drug is safe and effective. John Hamilton, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 429, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingel. Coming up next is National Native News. We receive support from the First National Bank of Coleraine since 1906, serving the needs of the community and working with their friends and neighbors, with branches in Coleraine and Grand Rapids. More information at ColeraineBank.com. Member FDIC. Central Lakes College Performing Arts Center presents a free staged reading of The Pillow Man, a dramatic play, Friday, January 23rd at 7 p.m. in the Dryden Theater on the Brainerd campus. Intended for audiences 18+, tickets are free, but should be reserved at clcperformingarts.com. Grand Rapids Tax Aid seeks volunteers for the upcoming tax season. They are looking for people to prepare taxes and those who'd rather help in other ways. Email taxaidgr@gmail.com. Now it's time for National Native News here on KAXE KBXE.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Alaska is launching pilot programs in Anchorage and Juneau to offer addiction treatment in mobile care units. Emergency responders will give people medication to help them survive after an overdose. Indigenous Alaskans die of overdose at about 3 times the rate of white Alaskans. Alaska Public Media's health reporter Rachel Cassandra has more.
Dr. Jennifer Pierce shows off a new SUV.
It is not really marked.
For the Anchorage Fire Department's pilot program.
We want people to see us as a beacon of help.
Pierce has a simple mission, to treat Anchorage residents who overdose and connect them with care afterwards. For the first time in a mobile unit in Alaska, responders can give patients the medication buprenorphine.
For when we respond on scenes, we can provide that very quickly.
Which reduces withdrawals and can get patients on the road to recovery.
We don't want people to fall through the cracks.
Narcan, or naloxone, is used to reverse overdoses, but it puts people into withdrawal. And research shows that offering that second medication, buprenorphine, makes it more likely patients will enter a long-term recovery. But Pierce says even if people don't continue treatment, the medication reduces the risk of a second overdose in the days immediately following, a dangerous window, according to research. She hopes the program saves lives.
Even if it's just one life. Right. We're saving lives out there and preventing individuals maybe from overdosing the next day or overdosing again later and dying.
Pierce visited successful programs in Texas and Washington for ideas and best practices to replicate in Alaska. Dr. Quigley Peterson says he's seen the healing benefits of buprenorphine. He's an emergency room physician heading Juneau's mobile pilot program. He says he's confident it will do well, partly because he's seen how helpful the medication can be in the emergency room.
We have something that can help engage people that's super safe and it's cheap and that it works.
He says they'll collect data over the year to see what happens to patients after they're given buprenorphine for an overdose. His hope is that it reduces emergency room visits and calls for emergency medical care. In Anchorage, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
A Navajo man was facing the tribe's criminal justice system after allegedly driving drunk and killing a 3-year-old boy at a Christmas parade on the reservation. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, U.S. authorities are now stepping in to prosecute him in federal court.
67-year-old Stanley Begay Jr. was charged with vehicular manslaughter and could have faced up to a year in prison and a $5,000 fine. Now a grand jury in Arizona is handing him 3 counts, including second-degree murder stemming from the death of 3-year-old Carson Apodaca. The agency's Phoenix field office is seeking photos and videos from that incident that can be used in the case against Begay, who has been assigned a Flagstaff attorney. He could face up to a life sentence. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Following this year's State of the Tribes address in South Dakota, Governor Larry Roden met with more than 50 dignitaries from 8 of the state's 9 tribes. He says he left the private meeting feeling optimistic about the future of state-tribal relations.
There were things that we were palms up with them as far as some of the concerns, some of the areas that we disagreed on, and we agreed to disagree, and we had more conversation. As we walked out of the room, we had built a relationship, and I think we'll continue to build on that. It was a product of just open, honest conversation.
State-tribal relations effectively collapsed during the administration of former Governor Kristi Noem, who was at one point banned from every reservation in the state. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Tribal Development Partners, helping tribes build toward their goals through 105L leasing and essential facility development. Empowering sovereignty, strengthening community. More at tribaldevpartners.com. Proud supporters of this show.
Support by the American Indian College Fund, providing millions of dollars of scholarships to Native students every year. Applications are accepted through May 31st at collegefund.org or by phone at 800-766-FUND.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Easy Cater, a workplace food platform dedicated to making it easy for organizations to order food from a wide variety of restaurants, set up employee meal programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang. The World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland opened today, and things could be a bit awkward between Europe and the U.S. President Trump's statements about taking over Denmark's autonomous territory of Greenland have created some tension, and it's only gotten worse since Saturday when Trump threatened to levy tariffs on European countries that get in the way. Trump arrives in Davos on Wednesday in what could be a moment of truth for Europe and for the Transatlantic Alliance. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports.
Rester unis, c'est le message de l'Union européenne face à Donald Trump.
European news has been non-stop on the Greenland crisis and President Trump's threats to slap even more tariffs on countries who dare to stop his plan to take Greenland. Europe is facing a choice between sovereignty and submission, says one newscaster. Trump's arrival at Davos will be a pivotal moment. Bernard Guetta is a member of the European Parliament. He says Trump is bringing Europe together.
All the countries and all the political forces were so shocked, deeply shocked by this incredible attitude. So, you know, Mr. Trump is making the European unity much stronger every day.
Trump is expected to make a bold entrance at Davos Wednesday with his family members and business executives wheeling and dealing. His presence promises to dominate the debates, said French newspaper Le Monde. The stated purpose of this year's forum is to promote a spirit of dialogue and cooperation in a contested world. Themes decided long before what feels now like a dramatic transatlantic standoff. Europeans are angry. They feel they've been way too accommodating of the Trump administration. The price to pay for continued U.S. support on Ukraine in its existential fight against Russia. But Trump's words this weekend threatening tariffs on those who would block him on Greenland went too far. Stéphane Séjourné is vice president of the European Commission. He spoke on French radio.
Le Groenland ne sera jamais américain. Il faut que le
I want to be very clear today that Greenland will never be American. This blackmail has to stop. The American administration is making a huge mistake. They're testing the Europeans on the fundamental principles of European construction, the self-determination of its peoples.
Bernard Guetta says the European Parliament may retaliate by not ratifying the US-EU trade deal worked out last summer. It does not include tariffs on U.S. products, but Guetta says they may want to impose them if Trump does not back down from his plans, which he thinks will backfire.
What could Trump do now? Invade Greenland? It would be a big failure for him, politically speaking. And even increase tariffs, it would be. very unpopular in the United States.
While Europeans are united in outrage, they are setting different tones, even between the EU's two largest economies, Germany and France.
Im Kreis der Europäer besteht große Einigkeit.
Speaking today, German Chancellor Friedrich Merz said the tariffs would hurt both sides and sought to prevent a clash with Trump over Greenland from escalating into a new trade war. He urged a level-headed response. However, French President Emmanuel Macron on Sunday called on Brussels to activate the EU's anti-coercion instrument, also known as its trade bazooka. No intimidation or threat will influence us, Macron said in a post on X over the weekend. Much will depend on what Trump says in his speech on Wednesday. European leaders aren't taking any chances, though. They've already scheduled an emergency summit in Brussels on Thursday. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
Nationwide, there has been a push to criminalize homeless encampments. City leaders say the bans protect public health, providing cleaner streets, less trash, better sanitation. But medical experts warn that there are hidden health risks behind those spruced-up sidewalks. Leslie McClurg from member station KQED in the Bay Area reports.
A busy corridor in Oakland used to be lined with tents and RVs. Now it's eerily quiet.
There used to be dozens and dozens of people along here.
Tony Carroll points down 23rd Street. He's a community health worker for Alameda County, searching for clients he can no longer find. Along the curb, the city has installed a row of concrete bins.
You know, what they're saying is no parking here.
The additions are a clear deterrent meant to ensure people don't come back. This summer, crews demolished wooden structures. They shoveled heaps of garbage into compactors and hauled away vehicles with forklifts.
I don't know where people are going.
Sweeps are up after a 2024 Supreme Court ruling allowed cities to ticket or arrest people for sleeping outside, even when shelters are full. Governor Gavin Newsom pushed cities to clear camps.
It is not human to step over people in the sidewalks and streets. It's not human to allow people to live 3, 4, 5 years in encampments.
Oakland is conducting far more sweeps now. 132 last July, only 19 the July before. That's about a sevenfold jump. However, the city told NPR in a statement that it prioritizes outreach over enforcement, with workers offering shelter and connections to other services before any encampment is cleared. But there's a hidden cost to those freshly cleared blocks. In cities across the country, people lose wheelchairs, canes, even oxygen tanks. They get pushed farther from the clinics and programs they rely on. Research shows the result is missed appointments, lapsed medications, untreated wounds, and more trips to the emergency room. Donald Sims is hunched on a makeshift stool near the cleared encampment in Oakland. He has gray, streaked dreadlocks. Last night, he slept behind a dumpster. He used to sleep in an SUV and store his belongings in a tent on the sidewalk. But then officials warned him they were going to clear the area.
Where are we going to go if we don't have nowhere to go?
He lost everything he owned in about 10 minutes.
One officer told me that he wasn't going to tow my car because I was living in it. And next thing you know, they came the next day and towed a bunch of cars.
Along with it, his clothes and toiletries were gone, plus his disability paperwork and the Narcan he kept for emergencies. Sim says he uses fentanyl to cope with PTSD from 3 gunshot wounds.
I've been kind of like self-medicating. I know that's not the way to go.
Four times a week, Alameda County sends out a medical van. Dr. Iceland Bird provides psychiatric care for the streets.
It's really challenging for our street health teams, who would always go to an encampment or a place and be able to see their patients and provide care, and now just not knowing where people are.
She's especially worried about people struggling with severe mental illness.
Schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and those, if you're inconsistent with meds or don't have them, can lead to really dangerous situations.
Paul Bowden saw that firsthand. He was unhoused in San Francisco for 6 years and now leads the Western Regional Advocacy Project. He says sweeps make it feel like everything is okay, but it's a dangerous illusion.
We don't have a homeless problem. We have a problem that we can see homeless people. And if we can make it so we don't see so many of these people, we've solved the problem. People get hurt.
The real solution, he says, is affordable housing and mental health support. For NPR News, I'm Leslie McClurg in San Francisco.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. If you have heard music from the hit show Orange is the New Black, you have heard the work of husband and wife TV composers Brandon Jay and Gwendolyn Sanford. Last year, they were among the many who lost their homes in the Palisades and Eaton Canyon fires that ripped through the greater Los Angeles area.
We managed to save my wife's acoustic guitar and one of my electric guitars.
But Brandon Jay says they sadly lost hundreds of other instruments, and it made him think about other musicians in the area, which brings us to this week's edition of Here to Help, our series focused on service and community.
A week after the fire, I did a Facebook post talking about the value of instruments, and I mentioned just a handful of instruments that were special to us that we lost. I talked about them in that, like, the value of instruments isn't necessarily the monetary value, but it's like the sentimental and the emotional value that you have attached to them and the stories behind them that make them special, and that I wanted to replace them with ones that I got from friends.
A week later, Jay and his wife played a local community event in Pasadena. Friends, acquaintances, and even people he had not seen in years showed up with instruments, some of them identical to the ones they had lost in the fire. That event would give Jay the idea to launch several projects to give back to the musical community. First, there's Altadena Musicians, a registry for artists to sign up for help replacing their lost gear and to exchange stories.
And then just kind of snowballed from there, and we got a website up and running pretty quickly at the end of January. And so people would reach out and, like, share these stories of what they lost.
The organization also created an app that helps streamline the instrument donation process, and a free record store where music lovers can begin to replace record collections that may have been lost in the fires too, which Jay says can feel like a bigger hit than losing instruments.
Because it's something that you collect over, like, your whole lifetime. And, like, you start when you're young with, like, your first album that you saved up for, or you got for Christmas or whatever. And you remember those, all the memories. And so many people lost that. They lost that lifelong thing. And we can just keep this going and start to, like, help people start to replace their instruments and their record collections and just be like this musical hub for the community, for people to get together and see each other and stay connected.
Altadena Musicians has also raised enough money to launch a physical space for live musical performances, rehearsals, recordings, and instrument repairs. Brandon Jay says even though it's been a year since the fires, he hopes this effort can help artists who are coping with their losses for a long time to come.
I just wanted to be like an ongoing situation because for so many people, they're not ready yet. Like, I'm not ready yet to have everything that I lost. Like, they have limited space where they are, or they're just, like, emotionally not ready. And then, like, a couple years from now, when they are ready, I wanted it to be available to them so that they wouldn't have to worry about that expense.
For more stories about volunteerism, check out npr.org/here to help.
Altadena, Altadena. Take a step into paradise, Altadena, Altadena, where the city meets the sky. In the bosom of Sierra Madre.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community, featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu available at rapidsbrewingco.com. KBXE presents Ski Palooza at Three Island Park in Bemidji, Saturday, January 24th from noon to 3. Come cross-country ski, snowshoe, fat tire bike, play music, or just swap stories around the fire. Bring a snack to share. Lake Bemidji State Park offers Winter Nature Art, Monday, January 19th at 10 a.m. Kids can make masterpieces out of the natural world. Park admission is free this day. The Grand Rapids Area Library Fund has been established at the Grand Rapids Area Community Foundation. The goal is to raise $300,000 by September 1st. Funds will be earmarked for the library's 2027 budget. Beltrami Soil and Water Conservation District's annual tree sale is going on now. Young tree and shrub seedlings come in bundles of 25, plus native wildflower and grass mixes are available. Order early for the best selection. Find more info at beltramiswcd.org. Elder Circle in Grand Rapids has monthly support group for caregivers at various times and locations. Find a full schedule at eldercircle.org. United Way Bemidji is offering assistance to those affected by last summer's derecho. If you need repairs to your home or need help navigating insurance coverage, you can fill out a form at unitedwaybemidji.org or contact the office. And don't forget, you can visit our website, kaxe.org, for the latest Up North report, bright spot, set list, and area voices. Now we're going to take you back to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang. A coastal stretch in West Africa is a future megalopolis set to become one of the most populous urban regions in the world in the next decade. The crown jewel is a long-promised, repeatedly delayed superhighway meant to slash travel time and supercharge trade from Lagos, Nigeria to Abidjan in Ivory Coast. But the task of harnessing its potential has barely been met. In the first of a week-long series exploring West Africa's most ambitious urban corridor, NPR's Emmanuel Akinwotu starts where it all begins, on the difficult road out of Africa's most populous city, Lagos.
Almost everyone who travels by road west from Lagos to Abidjan knows the toughest part of the journey is at the beginning, on the notorious Lagos-Badagry Road towards the border with Benin. And it starts at the Mile 2 bus station here in Lagos. For years, this has been the key gateway to the region, where drivers call for passengers traveling to cities all along the coast. This hectic bus station is one end of one of the most vibrant economic arteries in West Africa. So we came here expecting to get a sense of the vibrant flow of people and goods. But instead, most of the vehicles are empty, and there are only a few travelers and business people around.
We came since 5, I still stay here. No passenger to enter.
Mama Nana is a 60-year-old businesswoman in a bright yellow floral wax print dress. She's been sitting impatiently for a bus bound for Accra, Ghana, and has been here since 5 a.m., she says. But there aren't enough passengers, so the bus can't leave.
My father from Liberia, why the mother from Togo? Just between Togo border and the Ghana border.
She was born in Ghana and is an archetype of so many people in this region, with family and commercial ties that stretch across borders in West Africa, and switching effortlessly between several languages depending on who speaks to her. She's lived in Nigeria for 40 years, traveling back and forth for trade, but now much less than she used to.
People have not been going like before. People have not been traveling to make business.
Part of the reason is the declining economy. Nigeria has for decades been the main engine of trade in West Africa, but gradual economic collapse has choked it, with repeated recessions and a tanking currency. Compounding this is the road itself, infamous for being a gauntlet of extortion and abuse.
Too much. It's too much. Every point, they have to stop. Driver must pay. They will collect your money.
Finally, Mama Nana's bus is ready to leave.
So, driver, say we are going.
We say our goodbyes and jump in a navy blue Toyota to start the same journey with our driver, Peter Uche. In the next few years, this 600-mile road from Lagos to Abidjan will become a six-lane superhighway connecting ports and capitals across five countries. And this booming stretch of coastal cities is on track to outpace the world's major urban corridors like Boston to Washington, or Tokyo to Osaka in Japan, which is what makes this road so vital. But the pace of development is painfully slow. The highway project is backed by ECOWAS, the regional union of 15 countries in West Africa, but it's taken years to materialize. We speed down the Lagos-Badagry Expressway when we can. Smooth stretches give way to deep, gaping potholes, forcing us to slow to a crawl, dodging the wrecks the potholes have left behind.
What happened?
We pass a group of passengers wailing and thanking God for what looks like a near escape. Their bus has tipped on its side with a tire broken free. Thankfully, there are no casualties. Then, the extortion that Mama Nana mentioned begins. We arrive at checkpoints where stern-looking police officers with rifles wave the car down. Uche has to pay a small bribe before we're let go.
Don't mind them. They like bribes too much. Nigerian police.
They're foolish and like bribes too much, he says. But from here, it's relentless. We pass through almost 30 checkpoints in less than 30 minutes. Some are just meters apart, run by several agencies. Police, military, navy, customs, immigration, drug enforcement, even road safety, and even groups of young men holding sticks without any uniform. At times, our driver Uche can't help but laugh. Even though the extortion is painful, he ends up paying police about half of the small amount he earns per trip. So he barely makes enough money to pay his rent and his children's school fees.
Nigeria is very hard for now.
Life in Nigeria is hard, he says. Eventually, we arrive at the border, where all travelers face more extortion by immigration officials. We cross over to Benin, a tiny sliver of a country of nearly 15 million people, with a population smaller than the city of Lagos alone. But here the roads are smooth, with virtually no checkpoints and no demands for money. The highway hugs the palm-lined Atlantic coast, leading west towards Abidjan, through several cities grappling with historic change. Emmanuel Akinwotu, NPR News, the Lagos-Badagry Road.
The famed fashion designer Valentino Garavani has died. He was 93 years old. He was a member of the old guard of fashion titans, dressing women in the halls of power and in the upper echelons of Hollywood. NPR's Andrew Limbong has this appreciation.
Valentino Garavani, often going by just Valentino, had a signature color, Valentino Red. It's vibrant, it's lush, it exudes a certain type of femininity. In an interview with Charlie Rose in 2009, he recounted being sent to Barcelona as a young designer and seeing all these women dressed in red. And he said to himself,
I said, red is going to be my lucky color. And I think it's a color so good for everybody. And believe me or not, when you are in a party,
and most of the women are wearing black.
When you see two women dressed in red coming in, you have a sort of big, big joy in your heart because they look sensational. It's a very happy color.
Valentino was born in 1932 in a small Italian city. In 1960, he met his business and romantic partner, Giancarlo Giammetti, and together they founded the fashion house that made Valentino a defining figure in haute couture with beauty as a defining principle. He dressed Elizabeth Taylor, Jackie Kennedy, Meryl Streep, Princess Diana, and more. In 2008, Valentino and Giammetti were the subject of the documentary Valentino, the Last Emperor. Director Matt Turnauer told NPR in an interview in 2009 that Valentino's rise was just as much a product of timing as talent.
The world economy was very different. Fashion was very different. The world was very different. Women changed three times a day in certain levels of society. Women work now. The clients aren't there, and now fashion is corporatized. So Valentino was literally, to use the cliche, a boy with a dream.
Valentino retired in 2008. And seeing as how both the fashion world and the rest of the world has continued to change, it's unlikely we'll ever see another Valentino again. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Progressive Insurance, now hiring for virtual and hybrid employment. offering opportunities for professional development and career progression. Position details can be found at careers.progressive.com. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. We receive support from Lake Country Power, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative, committed to community and giving back through scholarships, youth programs, Operation Roundup, and more. Lake Country Power, made by the community, for the community. The Cohasset Parks and Rec Department has snowshoe hikes at Tioga Recreation Area on Mondays and Thursdays at 1:30. Meet at the bike trail parking lot. The city will provide snowshoes if you don't have them. All experience levels welcome. The American Red Cross is in need of blood and platelet donations to help keep supplies steady. Find a blood drive near you at redcrossblood.org.